the Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. This morning we have the Treasurer's Office, the Secretary of State, and Standard and Practices Commission before us to give us an overview of the agencies. The first up will be the Treasurer's Office. And I think everybody has been appraised, but let me once again ensure that so that you can kind of stay on the timeline. We've got 30-minute timelines, and we will try to adhere pretty closely to those.
Good Understand.
Morning, Mr. Treasurer, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and with me is Linda Haglin, Deputy State Treasurer of Oregon. And so between the two of us, we'll give you a broad overview of our agency and meet your 30-minute requirement and hopefully be under that. So this should go fairly quickly. I'd like to turn your direction. We do have a handout that we provided you, and if you start on page 2, I just wanted to give you sort of a synopsis of the varying things that this office does from basically an operational standpoint. We are an enormous financial institution. It's clear when you look at those numbers, we're entrusted with billions of dollars, both taxpayers, people's monies, different trusts, and it's a job with enormous responsibility, and I'm extremely proud of the work that my staff does in meeting the requirements of being a steward of money. But we also do a lot of other things, and you've benefited from these as well, which is to help provide advice, whether it's consulting advice relative to some ideas that maybe you are interested as members of the legislature. We work very closely with the agencies, the state agencies, to make sure that they're as efficient and effective as possible with the money they have, and as well the general public. We do forums in the public to try to raise the awareness of the importance of money. We started a program recently for children, a reading program to help them better understand the importance of money and saving. So we do a broad range of things outside of the mandates that you see that you've structured with us financially. In sum, we're extremely busy. If you turn to page 3, I wanted to just give you a quick snapshot of the varying boards that either I sit on or my staff. As you can see, there are many here of which have many different components to it. But the point here being we are busy as an organization either having me serve on a board as chair or having my staff be on a board and or having my staff these boards. So here, too, again, we provide a broad service to a broad range of people through these varying boards, and we have our finger on many pulses as a result. Here, too, we are also providing good work through a broad spectrum of things we do. On page 4, I just want to highlight briefly my role on the land board. I'm a rancher. I'm a timber operator. I'm a protector of the coastal ways of this state and the waterways of this state. The land board, as you know, is made up of the governor, the secretary of state, who I guess you're going to hear right after me, and the three of us have been charged with overseeing a variety of lands and public trusts since the time of statehood. And this aspect of my job doesn't often get highlighted as much as maybe other aspects, particularly in our budget. It does require time. I do take this very seriously. I think every land board member realizes that we're entrusted with something very special, the Common School Fund and the Public Trust. So we spend a lot of time making sure that this agency, the Department of State Lands, is carrying out its mandate and that we as the board are overseeing the varying policies that you want us to do as that entity. So here I just wanted to highlight the State Land Board is an important part of my job and something that we take very seriously. I also want to point out, if you look at page 4, this job and the organization is more than being just bean counters. I think often people see the treasurer's office as something that's sitting on a pile of money or making sure that the money is being well invested and managed. We're constantly looking out for new ideas and new ways in which we can deliver goods or services to our clients. In this case, you can see just quickly some of the things we've been working on that have been brought to fruition. Recently, we got there was an article about a change in providing stored value cards rather than using checks in providing money for folks through the child support payments. And that program alone for the Department of Justice has saved $1.2 million. So here again, we're trying to use technology, use the latest and the greatest in the financial world to try to benefit the state of Oregon. On the page six, we talk about investments, and certainly we can throw a lot of big numbers around the direct investments, for example, of our largest fund, the Oregon Pension Fund, which is now $60 billion. We are proud of how we manage that money. And in fact, Oregon has got a national reputation as being one of the leaders in financial management of assets. People want to manage our money, not because it's just the money, but because we have a brand, a name in the marketplace. People seek us out. And so as a result, we are seen as one of the top money managers, public or private, in the financial world. But I also want to say a lot of the work we do has direct investments into the state of Oregon, whether that's making sure that the Common School Fund is growing at the right pace so that there's more money being distributed to schools throughout the state, investing in new ideas or businesses in Oregon through the Oregon Investment Fund, which is part of the pension fund, or the Oregon Growth Account, both of which have put we're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars have been leveraged in the marketplace to grow businesses and ideas in the state of Oregon. And, of course, I help families in this state invest money for college through the Oregon College Savings Plan Network, which I'm extremely proud has been well responded by the public as we've seen generations now being prepared for the future. On the next slide on page 7, getting the bang for the buck, one of the key points of this organization is continually leveraging basically the relationships that we have to try to stretch the money that we are entrusted. We partner with the private sector in many cases to execute many of the mandates that we have. And through those partnerships, we can leverage services from those private entities to help us stretch those dollars. We centralize a lot of our services, and therefore cost sharing is spread out amongst a lot of different stakeholders, therefore lowering costs overall. The key here is value, and I want to say this organization has always been one entrusted with value, trying to make sure that the dollars that we have are either prudently managed or stretched as far as we can to keep costs down and make sure that we're working on behalf of the clients that you've entrusted us. Just a quick example of that, if you look down at the last bullet about a short-term fund, this is a pool of money that we manage on behalf of the state. This is a cash fund, and local governments deposit money in here. The difference in cost, for example, in just running this program on behalf of these two entities is the difference between 6 basis points, which is very, very small, and 41 basis points, which is if they were in the market, that's what they would be charged. Again, we've valued that cost savings at about $30 million a year. Again, a key point of this organization is to constantly find value where we can. I want to turn this over to Linda to just broadly go over some of the statutory programs that you have entrusted in this office. It's investments, the short-term fund, banking, our collateral pool, debt management, and the 529 plan network. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Linda.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer.
Microphone closer to you, Linda.
Thank you. Thank you, Dallas. How's that? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer, and thank you for hearing us today. Turning to slide nine. Thank you. I'd like to walk through each of the statutory programs that are housed at the Office of the State Treasurer, and let's start with the Investment Division. Certainly, this is the portfolio that gets a lot of press, and rightfully so. Actually, that portfolio totals now over $75 billion. And to help you gain some scope for that, that is approximately 3 times the size of the state's all-funds budget. So it's clearly a large mandate and a large amount of money for our office to be managing. looking at a couple of the big funds there from a size spectrum. OPERF, which is the retirement fund, totals now over $60 billion, and the Common School Fund just in 2006 crossed the $1 billion mark for the very first time. It's important to note that each of these funds has a unique mandate to it. This isn't a one-size-fits-all shop. That means that we have to look at each particular account and work with that agency who the money belongs to and develop a unique investment portfolio and strategy to meet the particular needs of those asset classes. So, it's again, it's not one-size-fits-all. It's many, many unique sizes. Each account is managed differently. Turning to slide 10, I've already mentioned just briefly how our assets are large. I think what's especially interesting to note is how quickly they have grown. And you're seeing on this slide, in 2001, we managed $48 billion. And as I just noted, that amount as at the end of 2006 is $75 billion. That's a 56% increase over 6 years. What that means to the agency is that we have to do more of everything we do. When you have a money manager managing a small pool of money, you can maybe get by with, let's say, pulling out a number five. There's a limit of how much money you want to have with every money manager, so when there's more money under asset or under management, you need more. So it's more of everything, and that puts more responsibility on this office to monitor more relationships. So bigger is more, more responsibility. Additionally, the financial markets continue to become more complex, and the opportunities for investing become more diverse. Over the same period of time, you've seen our portfolio become much more global in its approach. We're looking at investments in emerging markets that 10 years ago we really didn't have much exposure in. Just this last year, we made our initial investment in India for the pension fund. We have investments in China, functionally all across the globe, and that's both in the equities market as well as the fixed income market. So one thing that's not different here is, yes, it's bigger, it's more of it, but we always have to keep looking for new opportunities. So that clearly is a continuing driver for us. How can we manage this money better, whether it be cheaper or to earn more return?
Maybe I could just add to that point. If you saw the returns for the pension fund last year, we had over 15% return. And many of you know the target we're trying to hit is 8%. And so given the financial markets and the constant change, and, of course, we saw one of the greatest downturns in the stock market in history since the Great Depression a couple of years ago, we're constantly having to look at investing. That's I want to drive that point of looking for diversifying the money that we manage to make sure we meet that 8% return for the pension fund, particularly, over a long period of time. So my point here is that the complexity of the money we manage is driven in part by the targets we're trying to hit, the changing marketplace, the need to diversify. And again, Oregon can be very proud of the returns we're getting and have been and historically have been, but that's because we've been on top of our game and constantly look out for opportunities that have benefited Oregon.
Senator Whitson.
Excuse me. Pardon me for interrupting, but how much of those gains are realized and how much are unrealized?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, I'll need to get back to you with that information. We look at total return, so the percentage that the Treasurer indicated is total return. We can break down that information if you'd like. Continue? Thank you. If we turn to slide 11, I'd like to move into our next statutory program, which is the Oregon Short-Term Fund. This is actually a program that is used by local governments as well as state agencies. And it's a program where our banking section or cash management section clearly interfaces with the investment division. The management of these assets, which total over $9 billion at the end of 2006, clearly the investment of those is important. But a little known piece of what we do happens in our finance division. And it's actually how we structure the flow of money in the state to get it to the treasurer's office quickly so we can invest it immediately, but also the way we structure the flow of the money out of the office so we can hold on to it as long as possible. And that allows us to maximize the time that the money is invested for the benefit of the agency clients who are in the short-term fund, but also the local governments. It's interesting that this particular product is probably the one in the agency that is a free market product in the sense that agencies must use our services to invest their idle cash. Local governments, on the other hand, do not. They choose this product only if it makes sense for them as a mechanism to manage their money. So it's an important barometer for us to track local government participation in the pool. And at our next presentation, you'll see that in our performance measurements, we'll talk about the history of their participation. Turning to slide 12, our next statutory program is banking, and I've already touched on that just briefly in their role in the short-term fund in helping us leverage cash and getting it invested. This really is a behind-the-scenes operation, and what it does is it's actually the funnel point for all banking transactions in the state. They all come through the treasurer's office. It's important, and especially important, that this be a secure situation for those transactions to be flowing through, because you can imagine any kind of security breach or lack of service would shut down the flow of funds for the state. So it's a very large responsibility and one we take very seriously and apply a tremendous amount of resources to maintaining its integrity. Also, responsibility besides just flow is how do we make this cost effective to our state agencies. We can continue to be a green eye shade organization, or we can look out at the marketplace and see what is changing and what are the tools that we can bring that make it more cost effective, both in terms of banking charges as well as out at the agencies and the kind of work that they're doing. Some of the things that we do there is utilize the web, and that is both providing statements, providing information on accounts to agencies, as well as providing services for them to do their transactions electronically. An example of some success here is the move of agencies to electronic payments. In 2000, we had, for example, approximately 10 to 12 million checks running through our agency. In 2006, that had dropped down to roughly 7 to 8 million checks. The reduction is driven by agencies moving to electronic transactions. Why is that important? The difference in cost between a check and an electronic transaction, just on our side, our banking charge is 3 cents per item. So the more you can drive that, obviously it's an incremental savings. And there's also leverages off of that of other items that you save by using electronic. Clearly, this is a big driver for the agency and one that's a challenge to us to keep up with. Another service that the banking section provides is the relationship management team. This is a group of staff that will go out to our agency partners and actually counsel and train them on cash management practices and how to utilize these electronic services that we provide. So we do a good outreach to agencies to also help them along where they don't have the knowledge base to make use of those tools effectively. Moving to page 13, collateral pool. This is another statutory program. It's very small but very important. This is where we monitor institutions that are holding public funds in excess of $100,000. And for any particular deposit, just like you and me, there's $100,000 insurance at the bank. But when you're over that amount, there is collateralization requirement. The collateral pool makes sure that those funds are being collateralized appropriately. Moving to page 14, our next very important program is our debt management program. And many of you last week had the opportunity to go through Bonding 101 with our debt management division manager, Laura Lockwood McCall. I hope you found that beneficial. Some of the key elements that I think you'll recall from that presentation is the central role that we play in the state for the issuance of all state debt. The advantage of that to our issuing agency partners is we get consistency of product across the state. That's good for the rating agencies. It also allows us to leverage the knowledge and the negotiations that we've done on every single transaction and bring those savings and advantages to other issues within the state. In other words, by having a consistent seat at the table, we don't allow the market to play different agencies against the other. We demand that we keep all of the savings and the leverages that we've got in any particular transaction get applied to all the other transactions. A little known piece behind the scenes for local governments that we continue to provide for them as a service is the overlapping debt program. When a local government wants to issue debt, it needs to, in its disclosure statements, have an articulation of all of the debt that is outstanding over their particular jurisdiction. We provide a clearinghouse for all local governments where they submit to us on an ongoing basis details of their debt issuances. We retain that in a central repository and are able to generate a specific report for any particular jurisdiction. It's a very cost-effective way for them to meet their needs and is a critical service that we provide to local governments and one that kind of just gets lost in the mix. Moving to page 15, continuing with debt management, and I'll move very quickly here in respect of the time. The important thing I think you heard from Laura last week is, again, we're not green eye shades. We're not looking at issuing just fixed income debt. There are tools out in the marketplace that will allow us to structure transactions that are actually more flexible for the state, which better fit our budget needs, and are also cost savings. So we really strive to be thinking outside the box. Laura spoke to you about variable rate bonds, synthetic fixed rate transactions, swaps, and also using letters and lines of credit. There's a growing number of transactions that we're looking to every time save in those programs, and again, as I mentioned earlier, leveraging the resources that we have for all different transactions. Another part of our role here, just like I mentioned in banking with our relationship management team, is helping to educate our agency partners in these new tools. Again, because of our central nature in touching the marketplace, we have more knowledge many times than they do. Over the last year, we have provided 2 days of training on swaps, where we had 68 state agency employees attend. We also have had training on disclosure, and we had over 20 state employees attend that. So another part of our mission is to keep our agency issuing partners also current on issues that are out there and how to utilize these tools better. Turning to page 16, in the debt management division, it's not just all issues. We actually do save money, as I've mentioned. It's not just the investment division that makes money. The tools that we apply save money for state and local governments. I've highlighted here just quickly 2 things. For local governments, by statute, the Treasurer's Office must review all advance refundings. In the last 6 years, my staff in the debt management division have reviewed over 159 local government advance refunding transactions. The net present value savings to those local governments is about $157 million. For the state, an example of a tool that we brought to you to help address an issue was the pension obligation bonds to partially fund the unfunded pension liability for the state. That particular transaction of $2 billion is going to save in the 07-09 budget for the state $130 million. And that's in the rate reduction that we receive by prepaying the unfunded liability offset by the payment on the debt service. So the net benefit for 07-09 is $130 million for state agencies. Finally, on page slide 17, for debt management, again, we're looking at more transactions, more complexity, and also the marketplace is looking more closely at it. Disclosure has become much more important. We take that very seriously. It's become much more complex. And we're also faced with the IRS looking at us more closely as they do all other debt-issuing bodies. So we also have a heightened reporting requirement. Seizing on the opportunities out there also requires a higher level of diligence and we take that seriously. And this team of only six people, probably within our agency, is the most stressed to continue to deliver the services that the state and local governments need in debt management.
Maybe I'll just pick up here since we're short on time. Just quickly, the next few pages talk about something I'm really proud of as an organization, of a new program that was started. In fact, the legislature passed in 1999, a college savings opportunity for Oregonians to put money aside for their educational needs. These three pages basically highlight what this plan is about. When I started this, when I first became treasurer, I actually had the opportunity to open the first three accounts in the state for my three young children. Let me say that was a very small amount of money. But today I'm proud to say we have $780 million invested by the public in this program. So I want to say this to me is an example of how my organization can do something not only financially well, but also to help the public and meet its need. And I'm very, very proud of my staff and the work we've been working on this. Nationally, we've made some changes which will benefit this plan for Oregon and across the country. We worked very diligently during the last Congress to get them to make permanent the capital gains tax break that was given to this program in 2001. We achieved that. There was a bill signed in August. So now Oregonians know that every dollar they put in there and gain money, gain some value, is their money and not the federal government's or the state's. This is their money. That capital gains will be theirs forever. So here, too, I want to say this has been a great opportunity to not only help Oregon families save for a critical need, but also to educate the public in general about the importance of saving and investing. So this has been a very, very good program for the state of Oregon, and I want to thank the legislature for helping us start this and run this. In summary, I just want to leave you with the message, and I know we could be here for another half hour or another hour, and we will have the opportunity to give you more detail about some of our budget requests. But bottom line is, this is an organization you can be proud of. This isn't just me. This isn't about my staff. This is about you. You've given us the tools in the past to continue to do the excellent work that this organization has been providing the state and its citizens for years. We will come back to you soon to talk to you specifically about our request next budget cycle, or this budget cycle, and why we need those tools. But this is something you can take back to your districts and talk about the things we're doing on behalf of them for the betterment of the state of Oregon. So with that, I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here and look forward to further discussions with you.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Are there any quick questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wonder if I could ask the questions and then they could just get back to us opposed to sitting here and answering them. My first question is relative to the Common School Fund that you covered on page 4. And I guess the question that I have is the fund really being maximized? And can you say with confidence that the fiduciary responsibility of the Oregon of the State Land Board is really met in maximizing the funds for the Common School Fund? And if not, then what kind of steps would you recommend that we take to be able to maximize?
Just a clarification.
Fund?
You want to know if could we be more aggressive in trying to get a return on that?
Yes. And my second question is off of page 15, relative to the general obligation bonds rated. I noticed that we're rated AA minus by Standard & Poor's, and I saw some of the other reports recently as well. My first question relative to that is, how much did the establishment of the school stabilization fund in 2002 help bring this bond rating back up? And how much more could we improve that bond rating with a statewide stability fund or rainy day fund if we were to establish that in addition to the current education fund?
Mr. Chair, do you want, Representative Crummell, do you want us to bring those answers back before our presentation? Or do you want it sooner, or do you want it wait till we come back to our budget? I don't.
I think sooner. Representative, what did you have in mind?
What I had in mind is it maybe before you come back for your presentation, you could just send us letter that kind of outlines the answer to those.
I can give you those answers now, but we're out of time.
Right. And we are out of time, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Edwards, let me say in relationship to the school savings plan, children's savings plan, that I think originated with the class of 97 in the state legislature when the treasurer was among the freshmen of that class, and it was one of our agendas and one that he pursued and followed through his legislative career to getting adopted. So you are to be commended and complimented for that and for the well-managing and promoting
thank you,
because I think it's a great asset to Oregonians.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Secretary of State's Office, Mr. Bradbury. Secretary Bradbury.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm joined today by Gene Strait, who's my Deputy Secretary of State as well. This is a chair that you really sit back in. So thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's a great opportunity for us to talk some about what our agency, the Secretary of State's agency, is up to. And I have to tell you that I am very, very proud of this agency and the accomplishments of the agency. As an overview, I'll talk about our mission as an agency. I'll talk about how the agency is organized and the functions of each division, the functions they perform for the state. And I will talk about some successes, and I'll talk about some challenges that our agency has. And really, as a general theme throughout the presentation, it's really a theme that really binds the agency together. I'll discuss some ways that the agency has found to maximize efficiency while developing quality services to our constituents. And oftentimes, to do that, we found that basically the best way to do that is to use some information technology, some cutting-edge technologies to serve the public more effectively. As I think all of you know, the Office of the Secretary of State is one of three constitutional offices that was established at statehood. I oversee the functions of seven divisions: archives, audits, corporations, or corporation, and the elections division. And there are then three, those are the four program divisions, and there are three internal support divisions that help all those divisions perform and function, and those are the business services, human resources, and information systems. So in my role as Secretary of State, I also serve with the governor and the person who was right here before me, the treasurer, on the state land board. The mission of the Secretary of State's office is exercised really through each of those program divisions, which provide stewardship of public resources by facilitating access to and managing government records and information, and that's in the Archives Division, ensuring that public dollars are well spent, which is the real function of the Audits Division, offering registration services to businesses and to consumers, which is the function of the Corporation Division, and safeguarding the democratic process, which is the function of the Elections Division. And then obviously the other function is overseeing state lands for the Common School Fund, and that's my role on the state land board. Lastly, my executive office, with a staff of six full-time equivalent, provides policy direction and oversight for our four equally important program divisions and our internal support division. So you've got the executive office supervising. Given our mission, the agency must perform with a focus on integrity, accountability, and information. Providing the public with information really ties all of our diverse divisions together. It's very interesting. We've done some strategic planning and recognized that really the thing that binds all these seemingly disparate divisions together is providing the public with information. Now, I want to tell you just briefly funding for the agency. The agency is funded through a variety of sources. 19% comes from a general fund appropriation. 66% is other funds that comes from fees and assessments on agencies for audit services and the like. And 15% comes from federal funds from the through the Elections Division for the Help America Vote Act. And that's really the wide view of the agency. And I want to just go very specifically through each division in a little more detail to give you a better sense of what we're up to. The Audits Division is all about fiscal accountability for those who spend state and federal dollars. We provide this service with a staff of 72 FTE, and those folks do financial, performance, and information technology audits. They also manage a fraud hotline where the public can provide better information to us about things we should be looking into. And we manage the municipal audits program as well. And in this biennium, we completed all of our required financial audit work on time. One of the audits we do is of the entire state of Oregon. Really, we do an audit of the whole state budget. And our yearly financial audit is required in order for the state to receive almost $6 billion in federal funds. They require every state to do a complete audit to continue to receive those funds. We managed a dramatically increasing workload associated with the fraud hotline, getting more and more calls from folks. We provided strong coverage of municipal audits, and our auditors identified $11 million in savings and questionable expenditures through audits in 2005-2007. So found $11 million in potential savings. So far this biennium, for each dollar spent on performance audits, that has returned $5 in identified cost savings, and our hourly rate that our auditors charge continues to be significantly below that of comparable private sector auditors. So it's a very cost-effective operation in terms of our auditing efforts. And it's over 80% of our recommendations that we make in our audits are implemented by the agencies we audited. And for the 2007-2009 biennium, we expect to identify over $24 million in potential cost savings and questionable expenditures. So the division was charged by the last legislative session to reduce staff, yet it has continued to provide great service as a real guardian of taxpayer dollars. And when you think about auditing, it really, the business of audits really is significantly a people business. We are only as good as the people that we have on staff doing our audits. Retention of our staff has been a significant challenge over the last 10 years. And the reason for that is that our auditors are highly sought by the private sector, and they're highly sought by other government agencies who would like to have our auditors working on their staff, helping them do internal auditing. And it's really clear that our staff is really highly regarded as skilled audit professionals both for their high-quality critical thinking and for their problem-solving ability. So we've had a real challenge to try to make sure we can keep our staff, given that there's so many other people interested in hiring our staff. During the last 2 years, we've taken steps to reduce turnover and increase the retention of the staff that we have in the audit division. Consequently, we've seen that the average tenure of our audit staff grew from an average of 4.3 years of service was the average time that a person worked at the audit division. It's now grown to 5.4 years of service. And we really are very encouraged by this and find it as a significant shift in the trend towards retaining quality staff that we hope very strongly will continue, because it's obviously much more cost effective to keep our staff for a while doing the audit work that they do. Another division is the corporation division. The corporation division has a staff of 35 and a half FTE, and it serves the business community as the place where businesses start in Oregon. As of this spring, soon it will provide a one-stop shop for business registration requirements through our new central business registry that you can find on the internet. And I'm particularly proud of that, because it goes back to when I was first moved to Oregon in 1971. I owned a restaurant, and I was always quite struck with, I was not too old, I was, 21 years old, owned a restaurant, and I was quite struck with the number of forms I had to fill out to be in business. And this central business registry can, I think, really help particularly small business owners deal with all the forms, because, in fact, the web-based system will, in fact, deal with the forms and make it much easier to file with the state. The corporation division evaluates its performance by monitoring growth and implementation of e-government capabilities, and also processing turnaround time of customer documents presented for filing. That's another thing they look at. And they obviously look at customer satisfaction levels as determined by periodic customer surveys. This is something the corporations division does on a regular basis. They recently implemented electronic filing for new business name registrations, and they have implemented an online notary public training and testing system. And it currently has, the corporations division currently has 14 different online e-government services available through the website. The corporations division has measured overall customer satisfaction since 2003, and it's really very satisfying because they've maintained an overall average favorable rating of 97% from their customers over the last 4 years. And that's obviously very satisfying. The primary challenge facing the corporation division is maintaining performance levels for an increased volume of work with existing staff levels. And our largest program area, which is business registry, has over 360,000 registered businesses, and is growing. The number of registered businesses is growing at a rate of 5% a year. The division has continually decreased staffing, seeing a 21% decrease since the 95-97 biennium. And I want to emphasize, the decrease in staffing wasn't because there was real budget problems. It was the decrease in staffing was made possible by using technology to automate public records requests and transaction processing, stabilizing business processes, and by outsourcing certain functions such as cashiering, telephone answering, microfilming, printing, and mailing services. Those things have made it possible for us to keep up with an increased demand with a reducing staff load. As a result of the changes made to business registry fees in the 2003 legislative session and the growth in the number of registered businesses here in Oregon, the division now transfers over $19 million to the general fund every biennium. That's essentially the profit that the state makes from business registry. Now, the elections division is a division that all of you are certainly familiar with, given that you are elected officials in the state of Oregon, and it's obviously the most high-profile part of our agency. It uniformly interprets and applies the election laws that allow our democracy in this state to function. It serves the public by overseeing the administration of elections with the 36 county clerks around the state, and it provides information about elections to candidates, to committees, and provides information to the public. It currently has a staff of 15 FTE, and this year elections reclassified one position to a full-time investigator to focus on initiative and referendum fraud cases. So we're very pleased that we now have an on staff and investigator to be able to really pursue some of the alleged problems that take place, particularly in the initiative and referendum fraud area. The division is responsible for enforcing, as you all well know, enforcing campaign finance reporting laws, and it also administers Oregon's initiative and referendum process, which, as you know, is really an integral part of Oregon's overall political structure. We also publish and distribute the state's voters pamphlet to every household in Oregon so that all Oregonians have the opportunity to make informed decisions on their ballot. Now, just as technology has increased efficiency and streamlined services for businesses in the corporation division, technology has also benefited the customers of the state elections division. One of the big challenges facing the division was to meet the mandates of the Help America Vote Act by creating a statewide centralized voter registration system. That was required by federal law, and I'm happy to say it was paid for by federal law. And I'm very pleased to report that our centralized voter registration system, known as OCVR, performed well in its infant year of 2006, the most recent election cycle, and it protects our vote-by-mail system from fraud by allowing every signature on every ballot to be carefully compared to that on every voter's registration card. And it ensures that centralized voter registration system ensures that no voter is registered in more than one county. No voter is registered in more than one place in the state of Oregon. We've just recently launched ORSTAR, which is the campaign finance reporting system that you charged us with creating during the last session. And I really have to say that I am incredibly proud of the work of the Elections Division and the Information Systems Division of the agency, because they put a lot of work into the project and we're getting great results from the work that they put in. This system, which I hope most of you have worked with or tried to use at least initially, called ORSTAR, makes it easier for campaigns to comply with campaign finance rules and easier for citizens to follow the money. We really have the most full disclosure of campaign finance information, easily accessible access to campaign finance information of almost any state in the country. So it's really a wonderful system. I'm confident that it will result in a reduced number of campaign finance violations, because they really, it's kind of like a web system that won't let you report an error. It basically does all the adding itself, and it tells you if you've forgotten to put something in. I believe this system, like our centralized voter registration database, will be the model really for others across this country in terms of keeping track of campaign finance money. The elections division really faced an incredible challenge this two-year period, because they had the challenge of getting both of these systems up and running in a very short window of time. And I'm real happy to say that the elections division did it on time, and they did it on budget in the midst of a very busy election year, which we all just went through. They faced enormous challenges in the past 2 years, and I really am proud of them, and I hope you will join me in congratulating them in getting centralized voter registration up and running and getting ORSTAR up and running on schedule, on budget, and here we are. So, the other major program division is the archives division, which is housed way down the Capitol Mall in the archives building. If you haven't been there, I'd certainly recommend you go there. It's great. You can go look at the original Oregon Constitution and see the signatures of some of the people whose names are on the walls of the chambers and all. It has a staff of 22 FTE, and it houses and provides public access to the permanently valuable records of Oregon government. We house some of the state's oldest documents, including, as I said, the Oregon Constitution. The Archives Division is also, it's very interesting, because the Archives Division has really used technology extensively to serve the constituents that it serves, and the public and others, through publishing exhibits, web-based training applications, and 600,000-plus genealogical, 600,000-plus name, genealogical name index that's accessible online. And we also do allow for online rule filing notices, just to name a few. So it's really, we were the first state to put our archives online. And we've proceeded since then to really maximize our use of the Internet and those services. We maintain up-to-date record retention schedules that help to reduce the state's liability by keeping information for only as long as it's needed to be accountable for the public. But we do make sure that work to make sure that agencies are having an appropriate retention schedule. We provide advice, assistance, and training to all levels of government on a variety of records issues, including electronic records, which is really an email. Those two have really kind of thrown a loop to what kind of records have to be kept. And we provide free and timely access to the entire body of Oregon administrative rules. In addition, we publish the Biennial Oregon Blue Book, it's really a complete source of information on Oregon's history and government. But the Blue Book, the published Blue Book, is really good. But I got to recommend to you the online version, because not only is it free, of course, you'll all get a free copy of the Blue Book, but not only is it free, but it has an ever-increasing amount of information that state officials and the general public find extremely helpful. So I really recommend to you, if you haven't done it, look at the Blue Book online, because it has way more information than you'll find in the published book. The Archives Division also manages the State Record Center, and I'd really recommend to you take a little trip out there at some point. It allows for the inexpensive storage of state agency records until their scheduled retention periods have been met. The facility is staffed by two folks, and it currently houses approximately 80,000 boxes, and they guarantee a 24-hour turnaround on file requests, and it saves the state tens of thousands of dollars annually on storage costs for agency records. It's a big, whole, huge, remodeled supermarket that's now a supermarket of records, where you can go and say, I want to see the records of the creation of the Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee by the Land Conservation and Development Committee in 1973. And in literally 20 seconds, they'll tell you exactly which box to go get it from. And they'll obviously go get it, but I got to go ride their scooter and do that at one point. It was great fun. But it's pretty remarkable, that's really access to a lot of government information. The Archives Division has been able to measure its success by the quantity of permanently valuable public records housed at archives and available on the Internet, and has met the challenge with over 30,000 web pages of Oregon information, the most of any state government website. Now, those are the program divisions, and they rely on our internal support divisions. Business services, which Gene was the head of for a number of years, business services deals with professional administration of budget preparation and execution, accounting, payroll, purchasing and contracting and cash management services. That's one internal support division. Human resources, which is deals with recruiting, training, and organizing people that really make this agency work. And information systems, which Gene also most recently was head of. So this person really knows our agency. Information systems, which has grown significantly in the Secretary of State's agency because we are making use of more and more information systems in our delivery of service to the public. And they deal with the infrastructure that allows all of our online services and computerized efficiency solutions to take place. So just to be clear, business services has 16 full-time equivalent, human resources has 3, and information systems has 25 full-time equivalent people. Now, we propose performance measures for these divisions, the support divisions, to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee in November of 2006, which the committee approved. For example, we've identified customer service ratings for each division that will link to an agency-wide customer service key performance measure. So we're going to track customer performance, customer reviews of our various divisions by division, but they'll all end up in one benchmark for customer service satisfaction. While the committee did not require us to maintain a customer service measure for each division, we, as I said, we're going to maintain it, bring it all together. In conclusion, I have to say that I personally am very, very proud of this agency and feel that it really sets a good example for any governmental agency whose duty is to serve the public's interest while being responsible with taxpayer dollars. We control costs, constantly refine programs and services for efficiency, and really are becoming a leader in state government in implementing technology that makes a difference to our citizens. So thank you very much. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here today.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and it's an honor to have you here with us this morning. Is there a question? Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quickly.
My only question is relative to audits. Mr. Secretary, and welcome, by the way, who audits the auditors?
Who audits the auditors? That's a good question.
For the record, my name's Jean Strait, and I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. Chair Jensen, Representative Krummel, we hire independent auditors to come in and do our audit report. Right now, we have a contract with Moss Adams, and they come in and audit us.
Thank you for that. That probably leads an entree into the question I have. That question has to do with your auditors. What is the audit rate that you charge out to other agencies?
Chair Jensen, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I can get that information and let you know.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Not off the head either. So okay. we'll get that back to you. We'll get it back to you.
Yeah. I suppose the extension of that is a compare and contrast with what you pay to have your books audited.
We pay a lot more.
We'll look at that. But the issue here, or the audit issue, I understand by statute that the Secretary of State's office is obligated to audit every or any agency that has a change in the division or department head. Is that correct?
Change in direct. We have to do a change of director audit for every change currently.
It seems to me in my brief history here that there have been some of those that either didn't get done or were late. How does that stack up? And I don't have any specifics. I'm just, you know.
I'm not aware of our division having any real significant delays in getting change of director audits done. So I will check with Chuck Hibner, and we're writing it down, and we'll get back to you on that. I'm not aware of any specific delays.
Okay. That is not meant as an accusatory statement. It's meant as something that we want to follow up on.
Right.
And we appreciate that, and we appreciate it, you know, and I have been the one that has sinned here and taken you a minute over time. So we'll let that go for the rest of the committee. You're stuck there. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At this point, I think we have Ron Burnson. Is that correct? That's the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for Government Standards and Practices Commission. To my right here is Judy Stigler. She is the Commission Chair. And I'd actually like to begin the presentation with the Commission Chair talking to the committee about a little bit about what the Commission actually does in their role in our agency. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen and members of the committee, I'm Judy Stigler, as Mr. Burson said, and I am the chair of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. I was appointed to the GSPC, I believe it was about this time last year, about February last year, somewhere in that neighborhood. And so I'm sort of have a short tenure and have this bad habit of suddenly moving into the position of chair. But the Government Standards and Practices Commission came into being back in 1974. It was frankly part of the push for ethics in government that came after a lot of the scandals at the national level. And it was actually a matter of voters out there got behind it and pushed it through in a ballot measure in overwhelming numbers. So this commission has been around a little over 30 years. It is a true citizen commission. The membership of the commission is four members appointed by each, two from each branch of the legislature, a Republican and a Democrat from the House, a Republican and a Democrat from the Senate, and then the governor appoints three members independently. The governor also has to approve the recommendations that come to the governor through the House and the Senate. The statute reads that there cannot be more than four members from any one political party. I think the effort obviously was to keep it balanced in that regard. I can honestly tell you that unless I look at the roster and see who is who, I don't know what party affiliation is of the membership of the commission. I think I can honestly say that we
we proceed to do our duty in a very nonpartisan way. We consider the facts and of the situations that are presented to us, apply the law, take into consideration the recommendations of staff who have done the investigations. We have legal representation from the Attorney General's office there to answer questions of a legal nature. And I think that the membership of this commission, at least in my short tenure, takes the job very seriously, takes their statutory charge to heart. And what we try to do is to effectuate the ethics laws of this state in a fair and impartial manner. We essentially are, I suppose you would say, we're the judge and jury all rolled into one at that phase of the proceeding by the time things come down the pike to making a determination of whether ultimately there is a violation or not of the ethics laws of this state. We take our charge of confidentiality very seriously. The process is sort of broken into two parts. We have what we call the preliminary review part of the process, wherein that's when the investigation occurs, recommendations are made whether or not we should go further with the investigation or not. And all matters that occur during that preliminary review are by statute charged to be confidential. As far as I know, we take that very seriously. This isn't fodder for, you know, the water cooler conversation over in our hometowns. It's, in fact, you know, I can't remember a conversation I've had with anybody outside the confines of the GSPC itself on one of the issues that's come before us. When we sit down as a commission at our meetings, which occur about every 6 weeks, we meet every other month. We take matters under preliminary review, and then we also have deliberations in public on the matters that have gone through full investigation and are coming to us with a recommendation either for a finding of an ethical violation or a finding of no violation. The parties or persons who are charged with having violated the ethics laws have the opportunity to be heard before us. We take that very seriously and try to give them an open and fair hearing on the matter. I've been very impressed by the, the seriousness with which my fellow commission members take this position and take this job. I don't see that there is anybody there that has particular axe to grind, that is, you know, on any kind of a particular witch hunt. We take the cases as they come to us, and they come to us in a variety of manners. So some from our own motion staff, some information that comes through independent parties, formal complaints that are filed. So we get the cases in a variety of ways. But we do take the charge very seriously. We feel at this stage of the game that we do a mighty job considering what I would consider a paucity of staffing to effectuate the job with which the GSPC is charged with by law. So I think under the circumstances, we do more than a yeoman's job at carrying out our statutory authority.
I think Senator was ahead of
me. Chivalry, isn't it?
No, you were quicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, I just wanted to share with you and with Ms. Stigler, who I hold in very high regard, a conversation that occurred in the Rules Committee with respect to some of the ethics questions that are before both sides of this building. I've had the benefit of working this interim with the Law Commission on trying to talk about ethics and how to fund government standards and practices. And one of the issues that was raised, and you have it in the packet in front of you, was the amount of days that are spent on each one of these cases. And I posed the question, why is it that we're providing ethics opinions to for-profit entities and doing it for free? There were a couple of things about the enclosures that we saw in the Ethics Committee that are in front of you, where you have unnamed school district. And I know you're going to answer it. I just want to bring this to the attention of my colleagues. We talked about how some entities are not disclosed on here, and I'm looking on one of the pages, unnamed city, lobbyist, attorney for miscellaneous boards, A County Fair Commission, unnamed school board, attorney, government entity. Why these, if they're not held in confidence once they're disposed of, why it is that we can't get clearly who engaged with GSPC. But the principal point was why it is that when we're searching for funding, we are providing out of GSPC services to for-profit entities without compensation. And I think it begs the larger question that if I used to run a state agency. As a state agency head, when I went to my Department of Justice attorney and I asked for an opinion, it was charged to my agency. Why it is that when we're trying to figure out how do we pay for GSPC, we've got all this free advice walking out the door. Now, clearly the answer is we want to give good advice so that people behave and exhibit good behavior. Conversely, selling below cost and making it up in volume doesn't make any sense to me at all. And I would invite a response from the agency because they've now had a week to ruminate on my earlier questions. But I just shared this with you, given that we will see this budget. And in struggling to find out how we pay for this agency, I think these are legitimate queries.
Senator Johnson.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson. Just respond to the on the handout on the unnamed sources. Well, what it is that a specific person will ask a question about school districts or attorneys or so they're asking general questions about general entities out there, and so that's what we're talking about. We actually do have a specific person that asked for that, but the opinion is about school districts, so it would cover all school districts or all cities and not necessarily just a specific school district. So that's
sure.
Why we listed that one.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the response. When it says unnamed fire district, that suggests to me that there was a query on behalf of, or when it says jurisdiction, how do I know if someone's coming in and asking a question about the fire district or whether the fire district is posing the question? And I don't understand that from your response.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, a person asked a question about a fire district, not a specific fire district, and we do list the people on our website underneath the advisory opinion that comes back. So we do disclose who's actually asking the question, but they don't actually represent to us that they're asking for a specific fire district. They're just asking for a fire district. So we respond to them in that sense.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to take the committee's time to beat this to death, but I do not understand your answer.
I'll try to get back to you.
Good.
With a better answer. Thank you. The other part of that question was is on the funding. Again, I guess I would just go back to the discussion that the committee had about one of the services that the GSPC provides to Oregonians is advisory opinions and trying to encourage people to ask the agency before they actually act on something whether or not that falls outside of the statutes. So we give them an opinion, so we encourage that to come to us, and that's why we haven't charged in the past. I'm not saying that that's correct, but that is why it's happening now.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me one more follow-up.
Sorry, Senator.
We raised the other question at the Rules Committee about how GSPC, and I know I'm violating my own no acronym rule, but this one's too long to say every time. But the question about how they're structured in terms of do they have the right personnel doing the job? Because if I understood the presentation earlier, it was that the staff at GSPC formulates an opinion, then they have to take it over to DOJ. It has to be reviewed by lawyers there. Then it comes back to GSPC. And the question that I pose without having an answer in mind is, are you structured correctly? Should you have a battery of your own attorneys so that you're doing one-stop shopping at GSPC, and these are attorneys who are profoundly involved with your statutes, understand the kinds of questions that are being asked, and you're not just in the queue at an overburdened Department of Justice. Now, I know Ms. Stigler is an attorney, and so having the benefit of attorney expertise reposited in one place so that you're not constantly headed over to the DOJ with all of that additional set of administrative charges as these opinions go through numerous hands strikes me as an interesting question that your board might want to pursue.
Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, I think it certainly poses an interesting question as far as the structure of the staffing is concerned. I think probably what's happened is a lot of the work of the commission has been compressed over the last decade plus, and a lot of folks have probably taken on the burden that could be parceled out to somebody else, and perhaps the process could be streamlined if exactly what you're talking about was at least investigated as far as the structure of the staffing of the commission. Obviously, that would, change the bottom line from a financial picture, but it also may, assist the process. To be honest, I know the issue of purchasing the dollars from the DOJ comes up. I mean, I've been very impressed by the representation from the DOJ. I don't think that's an issue in and of itself.
Believe me, I'm not calling into question their professional competency.
But I think it is an issue of time and other obligations of those particular representatives. So.
Further?
Well, just to respond to Ms. Digler, it seems to me that if we're trying to answer a question to inform the county of Lincoln, 55 days is an awful long time to wait to get an answer for how to proceed. And I have no idea what the query was about, but timeliness seems to be an issue here. The other thing that I would say is we are asking other agencies in this session, notably Oregon Economic and Community Development, to take a whole look at their run of statutes that have accumulated over two decades. And you can almost see individual legislators' fingerprints on them over time. We're asking the agency to say, you all that administer these statutes know the best. So take a crack at redoing your statutes. They haven't been refreshed in two decades. Maybe there's a smarter, better, more cost-effective way of doing business. And I am at least holding out to GSPC that at a time when we're trying to figure out, is there a better funding mechanism, is there a better way to streamline the delivery of your services, you guys and your issues are very much in play in this session. Wouldn't this be an ideal time for you all that are the experts in the administration of your agency and your statutes to come back to this body and to say, based on our thoughtful review, we have the following 10 suggestions about how we could do this better? And I know that the director is new, but I think at this critical juncture in this legislator's deliberations, at least for all the touch points that I'm going to have with your agency, I invite your suggestions to this body. Do it with us. Don't wait to have us do it to you.
What a novel idea.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Representative Galizio.
Well, in some way, Senator brought up a lot of the issues I was going to ask about, just structuring, and you don't have to answer this now, just are there other models, and do other states have funding and structures that are different? That's what I was curious about, just to the extent you've looked at that. So I'm not looking for an answer today, but that's just something I'm interested in, would like to hear about. So thank you.
Yes, I think the whole conversation here is something we want to have more discussion on as we go into the actual presentation of the material from the agency. And interestingly, Senator, as you probably know better than I, one advantage of holding the gavel is having the opportunity to let other people ask questions before you expose your own ignorance in something and your own uncertainty sometimes about issues. So, because it's specifically, or not specifically, but the type of question I had written down here to bring up. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is a stew I have been poaching in all interim, and we've discussed ethics in a variety of different forms under the aegis of the Law Commission review. Rules has taken it up in the context of hearings on Senate Bill 10. We'll have a chance to talk about the budget here. I've asked the agency to come back with their unit pricing on what it costs an hour for their staff time to render these opinions, and I have the expectation that that would be a germane issue to come before this budget committee. There are plenty of policy questions about GSPC being asked in a variety of forums, but I think it's important for us to know what their unit costs out the door are. How much administrative overhead do they bear by sending the opinions on for a second review to DOJ? could they use that money to hire in-house attorneys? Those sorts of questions. And I make no judgment on the quality of the advice that you're giving. I'm just trying to figure out, can you give it better, faster, cheaper?
Thank you. And, you know, we've taken some portion of your time in the drilling here, but...
That's okay.
Maybe that'll make it less for the rest of the material you have for today.
Well, I'll try to be brief in going through the material, and so I'm just going to give a brief overview of the handout that I've provided to the committee. It, on page one, it simply lists the number of complaints and additional, or the type of complaints that are received by the GSPC. And I apologize for the acronym, too, but I think it's just as bad as Senator Johnson had it. One thing to note is in 2006, there was a significant increase from 73 to 108 complaints received at the agency. And I don't have any accounting why that's happening, but I assume that it's because of the increased level of attention given to the agency during the last year. The next page talks about some of the breakdowns. We were asked in the last legislative session to give a breakdown on where our resources are being spent, and this gives a breakdown of between cities, counties, states, education, special districts, and other. And you can see the percentages and the total averages between since 2000 to 2006, through November of 2006. The next page talks about advisory opinions and the number of advisory opinions that have been given by the agency. Attached to that is a list of all the advisory opinions and a time study on those advisory opinions. In the last biennium, we were asked to give that information to the committee, and so this has been provided. Behind that is a list of actual, there are two types of advisory opinions. There are staff opinions, and then there are actual advisory opinions. Advisory opinions are voted on by the commission itself, and those are binding by the commission. In other words, if the commission votes to sanction a certain event, then they will not come back on that party or any other party that performs to that advisory opinion. So it will not be a violation. And those are listed in the back here also, which I encourage you to read at a later time. There's some information on training presentations. Unfortunately, in 05 and 06, there was no information available. The former director of the agency had kept that at a manual basis, and my understanding is the calendar has left the building. So I'm sorry I don't have that information for you. But we'll be keeping that electronically now, and so that shouldn't be a problem, no matter who's in the position of director. There's a little bit of historical data on our attorney general costs. The next page back talks about lobbyist registration. The important thing here to remember is when you register as a lobbyist, you register for 2 years. So you'll really want to compare the 2006 and December of 2006 to December of 2004, and you will see that we have increased from 481 lobbyists to 629.
Senator Johnson.
Forgive me for interrupting you. I just want to raise this as an issue prior to going to the rest of the hearing. I had a conversation last night with a very earnest woman who is going to be in this building as an unpaid citizen lobbyist working on issues that are very important to her. She had no idea that she would need to register as a lobbyist under certain statutory requirements of time expended in this building. And I'm trying to figure out, how do we as a legislature and how do you as the agency entrusted with registering lobbyists get the word out to citizen activists who still believe they can come into this building and interact with their government and not understand that there's a requirement to lobby? Do you have that anywhere posted on your website or... any way to just inform citizens eager to engage with this process that there is a requirement?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I'm glad that you brought up this point because actually it goes kind of into my actual presentation in that the focus of this agency in the past has been more focused on compliance and enforcement and less on education, and we really hope to change that focus to education and getting the word out to people so that they understand if they spend more than 24 hours lobbying for lobbying for their cause in a quarter's time, then they do need to register. But no, we haven't done that in the past, and we need to do a better job of it. Our website should have, this time of year, some type of message on the front page that says, if you are doing these things, keep track of your time. Going, and just one more thing on that is that we really haven't done a great job, even with our own employees here at the state of Oregon. Are they keeping track of their time? We have training sessions each year with those folks, but have they been keeping track of their time, and are they breaking that barrier?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. It might also be a good idea, at least I offer it for your consideration, to talk with other agencies about getting the word out. Because if I'm a citizen lobbyist concerned about a very narrow issue when I live out in La Grande, I may not know that government standards and practices is the portal through which I enter. It might be a good thing to have on an overall website about the legislature, and you might want to go talk to Mr. Henderson about how do you spread your message on his website or on his literature so that people who are learning about the legislature and eager to get involved, put it in the blue book. I mean, I'm making this stuff up now. But figure out what's the widest dissemination of information so that people's first contact with you is instructional. It's not getting busted.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I think that's an excellent idea. In fact, I think maybe we ought to be on the front page of Oregon.gov right now. Just on maybe some little thing on lobbying requirements. That's an excellent idea. Thank you very much. Going back to the actual makeup of the agency has three programs that it administers. They are underneath ORS Chapter 244, which is the chapter on ethics. There's ORS 171, which is the chapter on lobbying. And then we also oversee the executive sessions underneath 192.660. So these are the three areas that the agency regulates. I talked a little bit about the agency in the past has spent most of their time on compliance, and we were trying to move towards education, and that shows up with currently we have three FTE in our agency. The governor's recommended budget includes five FTE. One of those positions is a training position specifically for training and getting education out to folks. The other one is a clerical position, and then there was also a reclass in the governor's recommended budget to move one of our positions to a program analyst so that they can work on the lobbying and SEIs, which I should not use acronyms again, I apologize, but Statement of Economic Interest forms that are out there. I really don't have time to go into the performance measures. Other than the performance measures, I would like to ask this committee, and I'll come back in the budget presentation, to really, we will present what we have here, but I'd really in the next biennium like to look at these performance measures and see, are they really what we want to be measuring at this time? I don't think they are. I think there are some that are doing that, but an example is performance measure number two. We're asking the percentage of cases that are actually meeting the statutory requirement of completing a preliminary review in 90 days. Well, should we be asking that question of, are we meeting our statutory, our statute obligation? Or should we be asking, are we completing the reports, in a, what do I say, more in a complete manner? I think Senator Johnson had talked a little bit about our outstanding issues. There are several bills that are inside the building right now being talked about. They include adding additional electronic filing for the agency, additional filing gifts. We haven't reported gifts in the past. They're looking at reporting gifts. We're talking about additional cities and counties. When this ballot measure passed, the cities and counties that did not vote for that ballot measure in 1974 were not required to become Statement of Economic Interest filers, and the Law Commission had included that. So that will increase the number of public officials. I'm sorry, I haven't.
Senator Johnson.
As a concluding remark, one of these issues also, colleagues, that we talked about with respect to electronic filing is if GSPC joins an existing platform, is that existing platform functional? There have been some complaints, and maybe you all have experienced them, about getting your CNEs filed based on the Secretary of State's website, and I think that's the platform that you're looking at adding on to. If the foundation is shaky, let's not build a 30-story building on top of it.
Thank you for that comment, Senator. I would like to part with, I think, a comment, too, on this issue of ethics. The Council of State Governments West has had a committee meeting over the last year, the specific purpose of which was the issue of ethics in government. That committee has basically completed, I think, their work at this point to be presented at the next national meeting, probably. But one of the observations that I have noted out of that was that there should be more education and less changing, altering, modification, or what have you, of the rules and or laws. And clearly, the education component, to me, seems clear, would probably come within the purview of your particular agency. So before we move into the, you know, I recognize this is something of a policy issue, but as we move into the rest of the hearings on the agency, I'd be interested in pursuing conversations with you about that as to get it back to the Ways and Means, what would be necessary for the agency to be a education instrument or arm of government on this issue of ethics in government. So,
Chair Jensen, I appreciate that, and I think I talked a little bit about the focus, but the one other thing I did want to talk about is in these changes that are being proposed by the Law Commission and by Senate Bill 10 is currently the statutes, they're asking us to try to audit some of this work that's been done out there. Currently, what a public official has to report and what an entity or a lobbyist has to report that they have given are not the same amounts. And so there's really no way to audit this. And one of the things that we're really trying to do through this work is try to get that those issues are the same. So whatever a lobbyist gives is the same that a public official has to report. So if we give the agency a chance to look at these reports and be able to educate people better, because right now it's quite confusing on who has to report what and at what time. Another example is just simply having quarterly reporting as opposed to three reportings in a year that the legislature is in office and two when they're not. There's one reporting for a statement of economic interest. So it's very confusing, and one of the things is in these bills is trying to simplify that, and that will help us out in educating folks on what they need to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time. I'm sorry for the getting off track, but we'll get back there.
No problem.
Okay.
No,